Shalom, everybody, and welcome to the Yishai Fleischer Show, broadcasting live today from the desert of Judea, the Judean desert. We're at the home of Rabbi Mike Foyer. Rabbi Mike, shalom and welcome.
Oh, shalom and welcome to my home.
Thank you very much, and what a beautiful view of both the Judean desert and of Jerusalem. I see right there Mount Scopus, and Mount Scopus means that right over that hump is already the Temple Mount.
I'm waiting to see the Amunah Anan, right? The smoke that's going to rise from the altar, right? They say there was a special little miracle that made it go straight up and never get blown away by the wind. So I'm counting on it.
A pillar of cloud.
A pillar of smoke.
Cloud. Well, smoke, that's right. Well, Anan means...
I said it should have been Amunah Shana.
Amunah Shana.
I realized I was talking about the desert. We're in the Parsha of the Desert Journey, so it's in my brain.
That's right. We are actually in the Parsha of the Desert Journey. I had to journey to your house today. On the way, I picked up an elderly lady in Efrat, obviously a Moroccan or Iraqi type Jew, older lady, and she had an aunt who had never been married, had no children, who was laying dying in Shaarei Tzedek. So one of the reasons that I was late here is that I just drove her to Shaarei Tzedek. And it was just great. What a great, you know, feeling was. Exactly. I was like, oh my gosh, what a blessing it is to take this lady. And this caused me to think about death, which is a topic that sometimes goes through my mind. I guess most people think about it sometimes. I think about death and the repercussions of it. And I was thinking about somebody who dies in this week's Torah portion. Torah portions. We're reading a double Torah portion. We're ending it off with a bang here. Matot Maaseh, a twofer, right? What do they call it? A double header. And the person that is very overtly dies in this week's Torah portion is our old friend, nemesis, our frenemy, Bil'am.
Yeah, I think he's just an enemy. I mean, God made him into a friend, but I don't think he was a frenemy.
Right. And therein already lies the thought, you caught me, there lies the thought that I was thinking about. One of the strange things that Bil'am says to us in Parshat Balak, which is his story, is he says, let me die the death of the righteous.
Right.
And today we're going to learn that he gets run through with the sword.
Yeah.
Right? By the Jews. It's like summarily, like it's not even,
there's no drama.
They're like, they find him, they kill him. That's it, right?
Good, got that guy.
And also we get another piece of info. We find out that he's hanging out actually with the Midianites. Remember last time the Midianites were like, forget it, this guy doesn't have any godly power to help us because God is with the Jews. And he was supposed to go home. And instead of going home to wherever he was there out there far away, he goes actually back to the Midianites. He was with the Moabites trying to curse the Jews but bless the Jews. Now he's with the Midianites. And Moses, Moshe Rabbeinu, tells us that he indeed is the author of the excellent tactic against the Jews. You can't beat them with a godly curse, but you can get God to kind of divorce himself, separate himself from the Jews, if you get them to be licentious with your own harlotry, with your own daughters. Send in your beautiful Midianite daughters, and this will co-opt the Jews into idolatry and into licentiousness. And Moses says, you see, it was Bil'am's idea.
And you see, like, he had, there are two meanings to the word evil eye. Right? The Midianites first thought he had the evil eye, like, you know, superpower, bring down the lightning bolt and, you know, all that. When they saw it was no good, he convincingly had the other kind of evil eye, which is, I can see the evil in you and try to bring it out. I can see where your flaws are. I can see. And he had that eye because, unfortunately, he was correct. We saw the plague. I mean, God was quite wrathful. If it weren't for Pinchas, who knows how it would have ended.
So therefore, Bil'am has also a tactical eye, not just a, well,
my,
you know,
my
spiritual...
point is there are two types of evil eye. I mean, there's the evil eye of the sort of heebie-jeebie magic evil eye, which I'm not really privy to its details. But then there's the evil eye of the people who look at the world in a way which brings evil into being. In the same way we talk about Mashiach eyes, right? Having the eyes that Reb Shlomo said, you should look at the world and see its redeemed state. And through that act of seeing, it's not a passive noticing of what's there. It's an act of bringing it into being. You do it with your kids, right? See the positive. You will see real change. So Bil'am has the opposite. He sees the negative. He sees the evil, and it brings it out in people.
But here was my thought today.
Mm-hmm. About death.
About death. See, he says, let me die the death of the righteous.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of doesn't.
Nope.
He kind of
gets
this. He doesn't merit it. But what does he merit, though? He does merit.
Down in the Torah.
Right. And I remember a Torah that I heard, and I think it might have been to Ishbitzer, but I don't remember who exactly, that like anybody written in the Torah is like a tzaddik in the sense that he got mentioned, in the sense...
I don't know if Ishbitzer said it, but he certainly treats them that way, because he famously, of course, redeems Cosby and Zimri from the Pinchas story.
Right.
So, yeah, okay.
He has a way... So I was thinking to myself, how did Bilam really die? Physically, he died with the run-through of the sword, okay. You know, and I'm thinking Pirates of the Caribbean here, you know, like, you know...
Run him through.
You know, do you think it wise, boy, to... cross swords with a pirate, you know. But on the other hand, I think to myself, wow, you've got a Torah portion where you got to bless Israel, like through you. And at the end of days, will all the characters come out on stage and take a bow?
Undoubtedly.
Right? Saying, I played that role, and look at me, through my evil role, I got to, and will Haman take a bow saying, look at me, through me came Purim? Will Hitler take a bow saying, through me came the rebirth of the Jewish people? All right?
It's a tough question.
And I'm not talking about the end of days. I'm talking about the end of days, right? The final scene.
The final, right? Last act.
Right, the last.
And last act. The what's it called? The scene, the call.
Right.
Right? The curtain calls call. The last curtain call. That's
whatever,
it.
The last one.
I hear it.
You know?
I hear it.
Will they come out? Did he bring that into the world?
To
did
some
he have
degree,
that
I think that we have to say yes, because we cannot get away from the fact that when we speak about one God, what we mean is that there's only one will in the world. And it's true that as human beings, we've been gifted this space to be who we are that somehow doesn't contradict. I don't know if we want to go deep into that right now, but just like our master and teacher, Rav Kook, really, really pushes very hard at this notion that your will is he calls it a shaviv or a stream. It's a shard of the divine will, and that is the human condition, which raises a lot of very big questions. But I hear what you're saying.
You have to be a channel of God's will. It's not that you can just work on automatic. It's important to tune yourself to be that. I just mean to say, like, it's something that you have to say out loud. We say it. If you read the Birkot Kriya Shema, like, purify our heart. You know, lavdecha be'emet, let us work you, serve you in truth. One of the big things I tell people about prayer, I know that you're a person who's very interested in the issue of prayer. I tell people prayer is not me, it is in part me asking God for you help me. But in large part, it's service. Mm-hmm. I stand before you and I'm supposed to, at this time in the morning, offer you praise like an angel and be your, like, I've come here to serve you. And to honor, and also I want to say one more thing about that. I was always very moved by when I learned the book of Daniel, that one of the things that God was so turned on by Daniel.
Called him Ish Chamuto.
Right, like this lovely, precious. Is that he was regular about three times a day he would pray for Jerusalem.
He turned back toward Jerusalem and prayed. That is where we get that notion from, and at least originally textually. And it's such a powerful image you're painting, because the posture of prayer, which speaks to me most, is a desire that God's will be done through me. And it's that drilling down within myself to find out what is my true will, and knowing that it's my true will because it's an expression of God's will, but that it couldn't find expression in that particular way except through me. There's a constant process. We could speak a lot more about this. This is my primary realm of teaching and in like the Torah side of my life. I have, with Sfaria coming out soon, a whole look at Rav Kook's approach to prayer, which is very powerful. So if people are interested, they can always send me an email, hit me on Facebook, and I'll keep you posted when it comes out.
You threw out a name of an organization. I've done interviews about with them.
They deserve some attention.
I don't know if people know enough about this, and we don't have exactly the time today, but the website is Sefaria or Safaria.
Sefaria.
.org.
Yes.
.org. And it's basically an incredible online compilation of Jewish sources that'll help you make worksheets. By the way, I could use a tutorial on how to use their worksheet thing.
They do that.
Yeah, I'd like to get that. I'd like that because it's useful and it's just like if you need sources, compilations in Hebrew and in English, it's the place.
Massive translation project.
Right, and it's done in it comes out of, I think it came out of Princeton. And it comes.
Brett was originally out of Google.
Yeah, there's when you get there, when you get to this website, you'll see that it's Ivy League.
Oh, they're the big leagues of information.
Right, exactly.
I know the guys at the center. They're some of my close friends. It's a beautiful project.
Okay, let's get to Matot Maaseh. We're going to have to, as we do sometimes...
Move quickly through the desert.
We're going to have to skip like a stone on a pond there. Hit the mountaintops. And it starts off... One of these things in the book of Bamidbar, where you have narrative flow, and then suddenly you'll have a group of laws, and then, like the sages, go try to connect these group of laws with kind of the narrative story that you're going to be told. The legal grouping here is about the laws of vows and oaths and nullification.
Yes.
Did I say that? Oaths?
Yes, I was just echoing you.
Yeah. Vows and oaths. Okay.
It's a fun word to say.
Yes. Not oats. Okay. Oaths. Oaths. And basically, this is about taking oaths, not taking oaths. And there's two kinds, vows and oaths. One is when you limit the object, and the other one is when you limit yourself.
Correct.
And we're going to learn also about groups of peoples, especially women, who at certain times in their lives will make an oath, and that can be nullified by their father/husband.
It's actually a deep window on the sociology of the world into which the Torah was born. In that sense, in the relationship between men and women, there's much, much to be explored there, which is why this section ends up in the sort of general grouping on the laws of women.
And we are going to, and now in the narrative part of this Torah portion, we are going to get oaths taken. Famously, we'll see in just a little bit, by the 2.5 tribes, that they're going to take an oath saying, yes, we will engage in the war for the land of Israel, but we want our inheritance to be outside of the land of Israel on the Ever Hayar, under the Transjordan.
See right out my window.
That's right. It's right out this window. That's right. Okay. I could see it out if you go out to this
window. You go out and lean out the porch, yeah.
I know this view. You know, I lived here for a lot of years.
I even knew it was there.
And then the other oath is the oath to fight and kill off the Midianites.
Who, if God gives them into our hands, then we will offer up everything and all of them to total destruction.
And I was so happy that we're going to record this here today, because the camp is now, we're going to also read about where the journeys of the Jewish people went, and then all the way from Egypt, from Exodus.
And how many were there?
70.
Nope.
42.
Which just begs the question of, what's the question that those encampments came to answer? Do you get the reference?
No.
We'll see if any listeners do.
Okay, good. Help me out. Thanks. All right. Yeah, help me out, listeners. Right.
You know why you need the question to the answer of 42 journeys in the wilderness? You can write me at Rob Mike at Blandvisual.com.
Is this Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy?
Oh, he pulls it out of the class. They could see the look on your face as you were searching so hard in the files.
I was like, what is he saying?
No, he's saying something.
I was like in the Jewish, I'm like 42. But I read that one.
You can still send me an email if you want.
That was like 25 years ago.
Before you shot.
That's right. Okay, that's right. Hashtag Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Hashtag I beat you shy.
That's right. All right. So the Jews are commanded now to take vengeance on the Midianites.
Yeah, it was bad business.
For what they did to us.
Harlotry, seduction, idolatry, nexus. It's
right.
Just bad business.
It's like, you got us. You got us.
And by the way,
good.
Remember, God wasn't going to sick us on them. We were just going to move on by.
Right.
Right? And yet after this, it's like, no, you can't let that rest.
Right, because they really got us. They really got
us. Where it hurts.
And they, it was an entrapment. It wasn't frontal war. They got God.
You know, it's funny you call it entrapment.
To get ticked off at us.
Yeah, but in that itself, you wonder, because the difference between, of course, entrapment and mugging is, somehow entrapment, I use you against yourself.
Right.
So you have, if not some responsibility, there's complicity there.
Right.
You know, and so in that, there's a certain bitterness, and one wonders about the whole process. I mean, it's interesting. First of all, it's tied to Moshe's eventual leave-taking, because God says, here's your last act. Get
if
rid
I
of
know
Midianites.
That you're blind in one eye.
Right.
And I do something to...
On your left side.
Right, to get
not,
you.
That's not what happens here. If I know that you have an overly unhealthy fondness for chocolate,
right,
and I want to distract you so I can steal your wife's jewelry, and I leave a bonbon on the table, that's what, more like where, you know, I've hit you in your weakness
right.
and used it against you.
Right.
So in that, it's not surprising to me that, you know how the whole thing ends, right? They go out, they wipe out the Midianites, they come back with massive spoils, right? And there's this text which we get the details of the numbers of the sheep, and which I love that stuff, even though it's always a mystery, like, why am I getting this? Because it's real, people. Because if you're a desert people waiting to see when the warriors come back, you're going to want to know exactly how many sheep did we get, right? And you're giving your tax to the, not the temple, to the tabernacle.
And the spoils were split between the people that came back, half to those who fought.
Very important principle in Jewish law.
And half to the rest of the folks.
Right.
The people that fought were only about, what, 22,000?
1,000 from each tribe.
1,000 from each tribe. That's right. 12,000, which is very little. We have 600,000 fighting men.
Right.
So 12,000 is a very small, and it's obvious there that God wanted us to fight with a small army to show that it's a miraculous war.
Right, it wasn't about
but
the
money. But they get half.
Yep, well, they are the ones that go to battle. I mean,
right.
They it's all well and fair. And that's a principle that plays itself out. It reappears. It appeared back in Abraham's time, and it reappears in David's time, that societies go to war, not armies. And so when it comes to taking the spoils, the fact that you sat back here on the baggage and watched the home front and I went out there in battle maybe personally may jeopardize the warrior more, but just realize that there was, you were no more at war, you were more at battle than the home front. It's an important thing, unfortunately, for us in our fair country. It's very easy for us sitting here in comfort to forget that we're a nation at war.
Yes, I find that to be one of the great tricks that has been created by the anti-Israel, pro-Palestinian lobby and that whole enterprise, is that Israel is the big, strong player here, and that the...
Yeah, the shifting of the David Goliath.
Right.
By the way, I can really trace you exactly when and how that happened.
I think you talked to me about it one time. Did you talk about Vietnam? And you talked about that they learned from the...
There's two stages. There's the in the 1920s when Palestinian nationalism was born, and it already ceased to be the Arabs and the Jews to some degree. Then really, yes, Vietnam, with the vision that was coming out of the KGB, sort of like the propaganda units, of realizing that media was the true battleground when your army and your society aren't the same, and it all flowed from there.
That is also one of the sociological reasons, which you just said, which is, you know, not norm. People don't know that stuff, how involved the KGB was in the creation of the Palestinian narrative story. That is also why, in large measure, Russian Jews are to the right.
They see the whole picture through that lens,
right? Because they're like, oh, this we know this. We know this story. They can smell KGB like efforts. They just know it in their blood.
Also, why, in my opinion, it would be a disastrous turn of events if we, as a country, ever went to a private army, a professionalized army.
I am so against that private army business.
I think it would be disastrous.
You know, and I was involved with a political party that preaches that, and I'm just like, I told them straight out, I'm like, you can't understand how wrong you are about this thing.
Because we have a big, I was.
But what's your rationale? Why are you saying that a private army is bad?
Because it creates an absolute separation between, not absolute, a much greater separation between the society and the military, and it's even easier to forget that societies go to war, not armies. And you look what's happened to America and the nature of the shift of American foreign policy and its culture, et cetera, to the professionalization of the army after Vietnam. So that was the number one reason. The government's like, I ain't going through that nonsense again.
Right.
Is there an easy solution?
Let society decide for me.
Country of 300 million people. Right. We'll just make it financially, you know, incentivize serving in the military. It's a great career for the people who do it, which God bless them for doing it. But it detaches it, and you have really two societies.
I left that political party, and I am very happy that I've done that. That was one of the things that just I couldn't abide by, and I just thought that it was philosophically wrong.
Yeah.
And I think it's downright dangerous. Yeah, you've put your finger on it. As I was saying, 42 sojourns in the desert, rest stops, you know, like Vince Lombardi truck stop outside of New York there. And the 42nd one, the last one, is on Yarden Yericho, which, again, you can see out this window right now. Those are the plains of Jericho.
That's right.
Yeah. And the plains of Jericho, that's on the other side of the river. And it's, if you go there today, it's 20 minutes from here. If you go down there, it is indeed plains of Jericho.
You know what I learned just this morning? Zev Jabotinsky, great sort of nationalist hero and thinker, unfortunately died in 1940, crossed the plains of the Jordan. He crossed the fords of the Jordan basically in the footsteps of Joshua with the Jewish Legion, right? The first Jewish fighting force that was formed out of the British you know, Imperial Army. But just imagine what that experience was like for him. Crossing into the Jordan. They didn't have to come that way. They also came up from Aza. But his battalion got to go over the Jordan. There's a lot, I think, to be said about that.
I just want you to know that when I speak to people and mention Jabotinsky, I call him our great rabbi. Just so you know.
I don't know if he'd love that title, rabbi.
I don't care. He is like a
rabbi
sage. He is like a gadol. He's like a sage. And so much of his Torah is so true. And just here's parenthetically, I just want to say that Rav Kahana, very famous rabbi, you know, right-wing rabbi, and sometimes some people
controversial,
and sometimes people compare some of what I say to how he says things.
Mm-hmm.
I was been watching it recently, and I don't think that's true.
Uh-huh.
I think there's a lot of differences.
I think he was much more raw than you are.
Yes, much raw,
and not just
much
in style. I think in substance as well.
Harsher, way harsher.
The generation of the Shoah. This is a different world.
Yes, exactly. And he came from the generation
like
of Jews. Right, they were still fighting. You know, street battles in New York and in other places.
Yeah.
We come from
a very different culture.
Right. But it is important to know that his Torah is in large measure influenced by the fact that he was a Beitari. He was a Jabotinskite.
Interesting.
And that is that if you actually read his writing,
I guess
you
I
see
guessed that.
Underneath it, he's a Beitari. Almost a Beitari first. And then the Torah comes on.
Oh, really?
Yes, I think so.
I don't know his Torah well enough. That's a big statement.
Yes, I think that people
there's a deep contradiction, I would argue, between Jabotinsky's thought and normative Torah thought.
I'd like to hear about that.
Not right now. We can have that conversation another
time. I would not say...
Not all contradictions are bad. I find many of them fruitful. But I think there is a fundamental...
Okay, I'd like to hear about that. In any case, we are talking about... speaking of Jabotinsky and all that that business, we have a situation in which they go out to battle with the Midianites. They slay them.
Slaughter
them and destroy, defeat them on the battlefield. Take their spoils. But they also take the women and the children.
Right, not just the women and the children, someone which they happen to notice and recognize personally.
Right.
Because remember, we just had that whole harlotry licentiousness.
That's
thing
why
with
you went to war
women.
With them. Right.
Yes.
You went to war because, and then you bring back, and then it says about Moses, Moshe Rabbeinu, Vayiktsof. This actually, this makes me a little, it gives me a little zing, a little tingle,
why
an unpleasant tingle. Because I'm like, ooh, I don't like it when Moses is angry. The word Yiktsof means frothy.
Yes.
Frothy.
Yeah, he overflows.
He
can't hold it.
Yeah. He got ticked off at them. And that's like, ooh, I don't like to see Moses in that situation.
That's interesting, by the way, because my teachers always told me that the Torah is written in a way in which it's meant to teach us about ourselves.
Right.
So it's worth it to contemplate, maybe not now.
Oh, yeah.
But why is it particularly that his anger makes you uncomfortable?
If I ever fall into anger, I have a half a day of hating myself afterwards. I try very much not to succumb to that thing.
And so you're feeling for Moshe?
No, I just don't want to see him angry.
Because everywhere he gets angry, there's always a tremendous lesson.
Right, right. No, and there's a tremendous lesson here. It's not like I'm like shying away from them. I'm just saying, ooh, that's a tough moment.
Uh-huh.
He's very angry. And he's really upset twice in these two Torah portions. Once now at these who brought these former, you know,
licentious ladies,
right? And then he's going to be angry at the 2.5 tribes. But
who
here,
seem
it's
to be
like,
balking at the conquest.
Right, they're going back, and he's
we'll
going to be like,
here.
And he's going to say to them, like, "Are you like those 10 spies?
We've
is that
been through
you?
This movie before, people?
Darn people!
You know
what
how this ends,
right? And it's anyway. It really, you know, you sometimes feel for Moses, who just he doesn't
sometimes
he doesn't.
I sat yesterday with a colleague over lunch. We were supposed to have a business, but what happened? We ended up talking about Moshe because she was saying that I'm just like I'm heartbroken. She's giving a shiur on Moshe tonight at Pardes. And she's like, you know, I've just thought about it. And Mamash, we took the entire hour that we had designated. She's like an important person. We had all kinds of professional stuff to check up on it. We couldn't do it. She's like, we got to talk about Moshe.
You know, I want to say one thing about Shlomo Carlebach.
Uh-huh.
When you read Shlomo Carlebach's stories, he has a way sometimes of making a small object or something that you've kind of talked about and you know about much more personal. He's talked about Abraham's knife, the famous story of Abraham's knife, and that you know this group of Hasidim went into this very you know messy looking restaurant, and
who would believe it was even kosher?
Right, it was disgusting, but the Rebbe was like eating everything so deliciously,
the meat,
and it's a whole story about touching and or seeing Abraham's knife. I like to get people to think for themselves. Could you imagine? And take the time to do what I'm saying here. Can you imagine what it was like to see Moses' face? Could you imagine what, and I'm talking about uncovered now, okay?
Yeah.
I'm talking about the full facial Monty here. I'm talking about the full Moses light explosion. And like, could you imagine seeing that face? Can you imagine seeing that face? I don't know. To me, it's just.
By the way, this is a very important exercise. Because, you know, now we're in these 3 weeks of historic memory about the destruction. And there's an avoda, there's a spiritual practice that at midday one should try to imagine redemption.
And I really
think that picturing the light of Moshe's face is a very powerful image of redemption.
Oh, yeah. Redemption, it's interesting you say that. I would think seeing Moses' face is more like the service of God. Well, I'll tie it in. You know, yesterday I was at a shiur by our beloved Rabbi Shlomo Katz, who has a beautiful synagogue. It's not a synagogue.
And by the way, I give Vault Teacher Live, if you listen to his show and you've never actually sat in the room with him, got to do it.
Yeah, no, fabulous. Really, really something very special. And I have a great merit of living in the same town as him and sometimes getting a chance to go there in the morning. And I see Ari and Jeremy and stuff. And Shlomo was teaching just about Jerusalem and these 3 weeks. And he basically said there's really two reasons why our heart is broken these 3 weeks. One is for the personal loss of being close to God and being able to serve him properly, because the temple is the penultimate way of serving God properly. And the other one is the loss of Kiddush Hashem, the loss of the sanctification of God's name.
In the eyes of the world as a whole.
What's that?
He's meaning in the eyes of the world as a whole.
Right, as a whole. And just, yeah, the general
sanctification. There's no temple there. People can look and say, what God?
Right. I don't remember how I connected that to Moses, but we got to go on. Time is limited. Anyway, okay. Moses is angry. He says, what the heck have you done bringing back these licentious ladies, these harlots? You know, they're not harlots. That's not exactly correct.
That's true.
They're really...
They're priestesses of idolatry.
They're sirens of seduction.
Well, but they're priestesses of idolatry. Remember, those two basic cults are death and sex.
Yeah.
These happen to be on the latter and not the former, although it ends that way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Freud didn't innovate anything in the human spirit.
and then Moses says something which I think many of your Parte students would I think there's a lot of them who are going to chafe at this Torah portion. I think
there's
just going
to a lot of chafing to be done in the Torah in general. It's
right,
okay.
But this one is like okay, I want you to take all the women who have been intimate
by man in a biblical sense.
Right, in the biblical sense, and I want you to off them, and I want you to off also the
every male
child, and you know, and here's a
girls from 9 and under can live.
Right, basically those who haven't been with a man that you know that the young girls.
I mean, truth is, it's very easy to speak to my students about these things.
Is
whether it? They, yeah, for sure, because you just say, listen, this is the world that the Torah was given into.
Still,
the reason what I argue is the reason it upsets you is because the Torah has succeeded in helping you evolve as a moral human being to the point where you now look back at the Torah. And you say, how could you say such a thing? And my voice, if I was going to speak in the voice of the Torah, back to you, I would say, because I taught you well. Mm. Right? Meaning the things that bother my students wouldn't bother them if the Torah had never come into the world.
I see.
And if it hadn't come into the world in a way in which the people who received it could receive it, then they would have never received it themselves.
But logically speaking, are you saying, therefore, that given the situation today, it would be morally abhorrent to...
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. The eyes of our world today is morally abhorrent what's happening there. Mm-hmm. No question, kill all the men and all the women who hadn't specifically had sex. If that happened in the newspaper today, you would call it a massacre, genocide, or whatever you want to call it. But to judge what's happening in the Torah here through the moral refining of 3,500 years is first of all, there's a huge crop of ingratitude in terms of understanding how you became that moral being. It's also just a deep misunderstanding. You know, if you pretend that this is not what the world was, then you can't understand what the Torah is, and then you can't even understand how you came to be what you are. And this is the characteristic of, by the way, this generation in general, which is a desire to completely divorce the past because it's messy and imperfect, right? And to say, well, that was then, this is now.
I think you're saying some big stuff here. I'm not going to go
stick
all the way
with the narrative.
Yeah, I'm going to hold on top there, but I think that you've said something that I think is an acceptable answer to your students. I could see people arguing what you just said is, you know, but the fact is that there is moral evolving from the Torah times already to the rabbis. For example, to me blows my mind every time that the rabbis the sages got to the conclusion that levirate marriage is something to
should not be done.
Right, should not be done. And that, and I can tell that the Torah is writing it as a kindness.
Yes, because in the social construct that, into which the Torah was given, because it has to remember the mystery of Revelation is it's universal and eternal, but it also is parochial, meaning you, if you, God's going to give the Torah, he has to give it to somebody who actually has a language, a culture. It's a real event. We're not talking about philosophy and abstraction.
But the tricky point here is, and I can hear a student say, okay, fine, so you're saying that it's a book about then.
No.
But how could you say it's a book about now?
Because that it's going to be eternal and universal, it must be given in that way. Mm-hmm. We could have a longer talk about that.
Okay, but here's the fun, here's the fun part. When you go learn for Smicha, the rabbi is going to open up this Torah portion, and he's going to be like, I'm not talking now about killing the Midianite women. I'm not talking about going to war. But there is a something that all rabbis got to go through that starts in this Torah portion, which is like, and now let's learn about the laws of koshering utensils.
Yes. It's great how it ends there. I didn't know where you were going at first. But yes, absolutely. Like, of course, I spent a lot of time with these psukim at the end of the story.
I love that. I love that. You're like, let's open up to Matot, right where the Jews kill.
After they kill them all, they took their stuff. But before they could really benefit from all those gold pots and pans they took from the ladies they killed, you have to boil them.
Right. And now
immerse them in a mikvah.
And this is what we do.
Yeah, today.
And when a guy calls you and says, my sink got a piece of meat in it, here's, you know, my
what do I
sink.
Do? Right?
What do I do?
Comes
this is
here.
Where it comes from. And
beautiful.
It's so funny. I remember.
Beautiful.
It's beautiful. And it's funny also. There's a funniness that, like, the laws of, like, meat and milk and kosher. My daughter says to me last night, she says, Abba, why? What's the... she said to me, God, I love it when kids say it the right way. She said to me, do we know the reason why meat and milk, we can't benefit from it together? She said to me. I said to her, I learned in Chabad philosophy something that works in my brain very much, which is milk is mother's milk. It's giving. It's it's feeding the babies.
Chesed b'chemla.
Right. It's kindness and
generosity.
Generosity. Meat is killing. It's red as opposed to white. It's after kill an animal. It's a slaughter. And
you can get milk and keep it alive. Milk gives life.
Right.
Meat
milk gives life.
Something's been killed.
Right. And so these are two opposites that cannot coexist. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, in Chabad, they say that's only in this time, but in the times of Mashiach, these two energies can coexist.
Interesting.
I don't know what that means right now, but what I'm saying
don't
is like
go eating.
When I told that to my daughter, she was
got
like, you know. And also another thing that I think my son asked a different time, that it's like, how is it that a cow, which is meat, can give off milk?
Oh, you get to ask good questions.
Yeah, and I, but in that situation, the cow is alive. It's a live thing. It's not meat in that sense. Any case, so that is. Let's just read these verses a little bit. This is the decree of the Torah, which Hashem commanded Moses. Only the gold and the silver, the copper, the iron, and the tin, and the lead. Everything that comes into the fire, means to say metals, you shall pass through the fire, and it will be purified. But it must be purified with water of sprinkling. And everything that would not come into the fire, you shall pass through the water. You shall immerse your garments on the seventh day and become purified. Afterwards, you may enter the camp. The people themselves were defiled through war, through the energy of death. They had to get sprinkled on, okay? And here's how the utensils, need to be koshered.
You know, I would say, by the way, aside from the humor aspect, there is, I think, a rather deep connection between this idea of going to war, taking these spoils, killing the portion of the population that we spoke about, and then boiling their pots. Because the connection is the great fear of the Torah is toward unhealthy mixture. Right? There are things that we say are nullified in a mixture with the things we say that enhance each other in a mixture. But the Torah's model of purity, of tahara, which is the necessary precursor to kiddushah, which precedes holiness, is a sense that you get the unwanted out. And this is a very hard philosophical...
What is that called in metal? Metallurgy?
Smelting.
Smelting?
Right, you purify an ore, you heat it up, you crush it, you heat it up in a crucible, right? And you get off all the slag, right? All the things you don't want, and you're left with a pure metal. By the way, it's not for naught that Egypt is called Kor Barzel,
right?
The iron crucible in which we were forged as a people, right? And going into the land is a whole different stage of crucible, which is why you see this continual concern, but don't absorb. don't absorb. We're meant to be, you know, mashpi'im v'lo mushpa'im. We're meant to be influencing the world and not influenced by it. Of course, that's to some degree always impossible, but the rove, the sort of majority posture, is always meant to be flowing outwards. And that's how we can, that's why the outward flowing spring is the source of all purity, right? That's why, you know, sort of boiling something to literally, it's what gi'ulei avodei zara is, something that, like, goel nefesh is like, ah, I'm going to spit that out, says Rashi in his explanation of why we use that phrase. You know, it's always something that you spit out under pressure.
I think what you're talking about is also true on the emotional level, which is disambiguate emotions and times. For example, the Sabbath is not like the rest of the week. Even in prayer, there's times for thanks, there's times for request. Mm-hmm. But don't mix that at the same moment.
You want clarity of heart.
Clarity of heart. And I think Rabbi Nachman talks a lot about this.
And
just there are times, like he says, you know, you got to be happy and thankful. And then take a half an hour a day. And cry and beg God for what you need, but disambiguate those emotions.
Yes.
Don't have at the same time. I find that ambiguity is a great challenge that we have today in many fields. In many fields, for example, the ambiguity that we send out to the world about what is conversion to Judaism.
Mm.
The ambiguity that we send out about what is kosher today,
mm-hmm.
food. The ambiguity that we send out about what we're going to do with the Palestinians, with the Arabs, and all that kind of stuff. We are constantly sending out ambiguous messages.
You know what's happened, I think, is that you have to remember, of course, that all
and when,
of those...
when you argue with young people, they will jump from issue
yes.
to issue because...
Well, because there's a worship of nuance for nuance sake and complexity for complexity's sake right now, which is symptomatic of the postmodern mind.
Do you know who's a sinner in that?
Who's that?
There's a guy who is a sinner.
Be careful, you're going to call him a sinner. Ooh.
When it comes to this.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I will call him that.
Yeah? Okay.
You know what? The name
can't
is
even
blanking.
Remember who it is.
No, I know exactly who it is.
Because he called him a sinner.
You know exactly who it is, but you know what? Maybe God does not want me to say who it is, but it is an author today who writes about the problems with the Arabs and the Jews in Israel, and he's a very prolific author, and he is always going to complexify issues
yes.
instead of reducing them, and he's in love with complexities
yes.
and the inner churning turmoil.
And by the way, it's very Jewish because, of course, you look back.
And he stops
classic,
us from making good policy.
Wow, but here's the thing. It's very classic. If you look from these verses in the Torah, if you go all the way down through the complexities of law to the question of whether I have to put this plastic cup I'm holding right now, if I have to boil it or if I have to immerse it in a, you know. So you can understand why there's a mindset toward, well, listen, there's always different sides to everything. But it's a misunderstanding of the process as a whole, because that's true. All those sides, right up until I actually want to use this cup.
Right.
If I actually want to do something in the world,
right.
So I have to make a decision.
That's right.
And that's so much of what's plaguing our culture today, is that skipping from nuance to nuance, from side to side that you were speaking about, has become, I think often subconsciously, but sometimes deliberately, a way to just simply avoid the hard reality that choices exclude, that anytime you put your will forward in the world, it's going to have edges. Right, and that organic processes that move forward in life are messy. They're never clean. And that doesn't mean they're wrong. Life is good, but if you've ever been present at a birth, you know it's about as messy as it gets.
Yes, policy means making choices.
In the real world.
Right, and this author, whose name I do remember now, but I'll think about if I should say it in that way I said it, so I'll skip out on it for now. He's causing a lot of trouble, and he's making a good living at like lecturing and speaking and writing about this ambiguities.
Right.
And he's hurting the cause, and he's hurting both the peoples that he's so.
Well, I think it's always important to remember that is that in many ways, right now, listen, Baruch Hashem, life is good here. You're sitting in my house, like I'm happy to hang out with you. But and the Arabs around us are suffering, and part of that suffering, go back to Jabotinsky. Is our unwillingness to put up an iron wall, to say, listen, we're here, we're not going anywhere. So can we actually make a real deal now?
Everybody's suffering from their lack of clarity.
Yeah, lack of clarity is the problem in the region.
That's right, exactly. It's time to clear it up and to say what we want and do what we want and make it clear. And yes, there'll be a lot of naysayers, but we'll
trudge
forward.
There are a lot of naysayers right now.
Right, exactly. Okay, the other issue was... we talked about before, the separation of the tithes, the separation of the spoils of war. That was a big issue in this Torah portion. And there's another very interesting part where where the fighters come back to the commanders of the thousands of the legions, the 12,000 people, and the officers of the thousands of the officers of the hundreds approach Moses. They came to Moses. They said, your servants took a census of the men at war and under our command, and not a man is missing.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And there's two points here. One is we had a miraculous war with a small army. Nope, everybody came back alive. And the other one is I read in the Balaturim, none of us sinned. Mm-hmm. We didn't fall.
Right.
We didn't succumb to these Midianite gals. So we've brought an offering for Hashem. Each man that he has found, the gold vessel, anklet, bracelet, ring, earring, clasp, to atone for our souls before Hashem. Moshe and Eleazar the Kohen, now we see also the transition. It's no longer Aharon, it's Eleazar. Eleazar, by the way, a very important transition character. Also another hero, a new hero, very important
for
hero.
For sure, linked to Yoshua in a real way.
Right, absolutely. In fact, I saw in last week's Torah portion, I was reading it over Shabbat, it said that like Moses was trying to offer his sons up to be the next leaders. God says to him, no, they're not worthy. Joshua is, but your family, the children of Eleazar and his children, are like your sons,
right?
And they're in your family, and he will always have to consult them. Mm-hmm. So your children are going to be leaders. I saw that in my favorite book of them all. If I had to be dropped on a desert island with one set of books.
I know what it is.
Yeah.
Mamluez.
That's right. That's right. Mamluez will teach you everything.
It's awesome. And it's a good read.
It's a great read.
That was his whole point.
Right.
It was originally written in Ladino, which is the sort of a colloquial language, the what's called vernacular, of the sort of Sephardic diaspora.
I always say to myself, if I just had this year to learn one book, I would just learn, you know, and it has everything. It has laws. It has everything.
Yeah,
it's fabulous.
Fabulous. It's genius work.
Okay. All right. So then, okay, now we get to the tricky bit, which is the request of Reuven and Gad, who they're attacked on. Tribe is going to be Menashe. Half a tribe is going to be tacked on. And they basically say, look, we've actually benefited from this war a lot. We've gotten a lot of spoils, and we look at the Transjordan. It's an excellent where we are right now. Is they say our portion has come to us.
Right. It's pasture country. We have a lot of cattle.
Hey. Right. And Moses sees in their language a little bit too much materialism. He sees that they put the cattle in front of the families.
Yep.
He gives them a hard time. And he also says to them.
He warned people.
Right. He says to them, you're too materialistic in one sense. There's a hint there. And he also says to them, what do you mean? You're gonna quit on the mission?
To balk. You're right on the edge of the land. You don't balk in this moment.
Big disappointment.
More than anything else, even though, of course, they make it up and it's all well in the end, you could just hear Moshe's heart skip. Hear it skip, because I wonder how relieved he was when God said to him, okay, this is the last battle, and then you're going to go up on the mountain.
Right.
At a certain point, it has not been an easy journey.
No.
It has not been an easy journey, and he's done well. He has got his flock to the edge of the land.
That's right.
He wants to hand them off.
He sees the finish line.
He sees the finish line. He's like, are you joking? I feel for Moshe in this moment.
Yeah, yeah. And he's viscerally upset, and he says to them, "Come on," and then they say, "No, we're going to send people ahead to battle. It's going to be a 7-year conquest."
Ends up being 7 years of conquest, and 7 years they commit themselves, even though Moshe doesn't ask them to also be there for the division.
Right, 14 years of stuff. So actually, they're saying something pretty big, which is we're going to go into the land, we're going to fight, but we want to come back here.
Right.
To me,
we'll leave our families behind.
Right. To me, it's how do you know that you're going to want to come back? Maybe you'll see a better portion. But somehow they already know that their portion has come to them.
You know, the Midrash is concerned about the opposite. It says when they go home after 14 years, they find their wives with all these grown men, and they think that they've been supplanted, and they start to go to war, and they realize, who are they?
They're children.
They're children.
Right. Let me tell you a story. I was once at an APAC convention.
Mm-hmm.
This is the same group of people that I was talking about, that author.
Yes.
There's the same group of people that run the APAC Shabbat. They used to anyway. And that's the folks from the, I guess God doesn't
God
want me to say.
God is on your case
yeah,
right now.
He doesn't
now.
Want me to say.
There's some folks.
It's some folks, and they run a think tank and a teaching institute that's very successful and very powerful. Anyway, so these folks were giving a lesson. One of them was giving a talk about the relationship of diaspora Jews to the Israeli Jews, and they gave three models.
Right, we've spoken about this.
Right. One model was Lot.
Right.
Yeah, and you see, he's still
he
related
went
to
the left,
Lot,
and Abram went to the right.
But they're still
but
related.
They're still family.
Right. And the other one was The other one was the 2.5 tribes.
Uh-huh.
And the other one was that were in the Transjordan, and the other one was the Jews of Egypt and Alexandria.
Yeah, Hellenistic Judaism, right.
And he was giving
none of those end well.
He gives a talk about how this is how we can understand American Jewry vis-a-vis.
I mean, you can understand them that way, but
right.
None of them end well.
So I raised my hand. I'm like, dude, the Lod people became a different nation, two different nations that we ended up fighting. The 2.5 tribes were the first to be exiled, and the Alexandria thing, the
got
minute
absorbed
there was,
into Christianity,
right? And one earthquake off their whole big synagogue, and the whole thing was done.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this is who you bring up to these people as the future.
Unless he was saying, so you should beware and pick up and move to Israel.
He was
which
not.
He wasn't. I know.
He was not. And by the way, I'm not even saying pick up and move to Israel. Sure, that's option number one. But option two is like
identify with the project.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Identify with the project. Exactly. I hope that's the name of the show today. Okay. Identify with the project. I like that. That's a great name for the show. Any case.
You can tip me later.
I shall. 2.5 tribes. By the way, another little mention here of Moses recounts the whole spy story and basically says to them, you know, here you are in that bad culture. Ooh. Tarbut ra'ah.
Yeah.
Bad culture. Hashtag bad culture.
Yeah. that word cuts deep.
It cuts deep. And he remembers Isaac, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Anyway, they make an oath. And for here we learn the laws of taking a double oath, an oath. And they promise to go in. He also will
just go in. Shock troops.
Shock
they
troops
go in first.
They'll go in first, which is in some sense you have to give them a lot of respect. They're saying,
there's a deep question in my mind whether Moshe misread the situation, which is possible, or whether his reaction shamed them into sort of like saving face of like, no, what we really meant was.
Well, you know, it's like the war between the Gra and the Mitnagdim and the Hasidim.
Uh-huh.
Some people say it was a horrible war and was a misread. Other people say if it wasn't for the Gra's intensity, then the Hasidim
might have gone off the rails.
Might have gone off the rails.
That's a very good point.
Right. So
that's interesting. Thank you for throwing that in there in the mix.
Yeah,
I appreciate that. I spent a lot of time thinking about that time period.
Yeah,
which still plays itself out in our present
the
religious culture.
The Gra was too great of a man to just misread it. I just don't believe that.
And the Gra had a what we call a shtickle kanoi. Right? Right. He had a little bit of that zealotry in him, in the sense that he was well aware of how great he was, and therefore anything that seemed wrong to him. You know, famously they tell the story that we say that the greater a person is, the greater their yetzahara, their evil inclination is. So someone actually once had the sort of chutzpah to ask the Gra, so what's your yetzahara? And his answer was a avodah zara. Could you imagine?
My favorite thing, and I might have heard it on your show, was when the Gra like had a eureka moment and realized what his work was, and he was like to be like Mashiach ben Yosef in our time and to herald the return to Zion.
You didn't hear it from me, but I've heard that
before. I just love
his students certainly carried that flag forward here in Eretz Yisrael.
Right. And here, on the other hand, him and the Hasidim were on the same page.
His students were. I mean, he didn't make it here.
But I'm saying the Hasidut students also.
It was beautiful that one of the things that happened here in Eretz Yisrael, this was one of the first places that the Hasidim and the Mitnagdim actually found common cause. Because I think of the Messianic vessel that is Eretz Yisrael.
Yafeh. Okay, we got to skip forward now to the Torah portion of Masae. In Masae are the journeys, 42 journeys in the land, as I said before. And
send me hashtag I beat Yishai.
Right. And if you read the Baal HaTurim, for example, every stop along this trail, all the separate names have a meaning to
it. Oh, absolutely.
Okay?
Unbelievable. We're not going to do them all, are we?
We're not going to do them now, but
it's just another reminder that there is no empty verbiage.
Right.
In the Torah.
That's right. That's right. And it starts again at Exodus. So we're at the book. We're finished. In many ways, we're about to finish the Torah.
Yes, absolutely.
Right. Like, we're finishing the four books and at the edge. From here on, the next book, it's a different book.
This is why the sages called it Mishneh Torah, the retelling of the Torah.
Right. But it's a different style.
Different style.
A different thing. And I've seen also in Kabbalistic things and in codes. Like, it's just a... It's like a inverse book. It's a book written a different way.
My whole approach to the Jewish story and our relationship to our past was founded on the learning I did around the relationship between Devarim and the other four books of the Torah.
Now let us go to the famous phrase where basically God says to them, listen, I'm going to give you the borders of the land And in those borders, by the way, is a large chunk of Lebanon. And in
modern-day Jordan.
Right.
I mean, that was where the tribes stayed on the other side. We call it
right.
Transjordan.
Just for a second, I want to just hold on to Lebanon for a second. I have a lot of...
Last time that you tried to hold on to Lebanon for a second, didn't end well. Oh, sorry. Couldn't resist.
I have Lebanese friends.
Uh-huh.
You know, Khala bin Aleppo, from Aleppo and from Beirut and the whole thing. I mean, I know they separate it all out. For me, it's like it's a related business. Okay, they
to the Syrians as well.
Right? They separate it, but for me, it's a related. But especially, you know, I've been reading a little bit more about Mount Lebanon, the Cedars of Lebanon. Do you know that there's a park in Lebanon called Cedars of God, which they basically have stopped cutting down those beautiful.
They have any old growth in Lebanon?
Huh?
They have old growth forests.
Yes, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. It's a park called Cedars of God. Cedars of God.
Yeah, well, for good reason.
I mean, their flag has the cedar of Lebanon.
I understand that, but and I've seen the redwoods. I was just wondering. Like,
if you go to Brooklyn, there's a synagogue called Har HaLevanon.
Right.
And that's the other name also for the temple.
It is Kinui for either Jerusalem or the temple, yeah.
Right. And in fact, the cedars of Lebanon came on boats.
Yes.
From the Lebanon.
They didn't come on boats. They were tied together as rafts.
Rafts, yeah, on a seafaring.
No, but meaning they themselves were tied together as rafts. They didn't
right,
put
like
them on a
like
boat.
Like Contiki. Yeah. I got it. I know.
Tom Sawyer.
Yeah. All right. The
Contiki was a boat.
No, it was a raft.
Wasn't it?
No, the Contiki was a slung together balsam wood raft.
Okay.
That was the Polynesian. That was the theory that the Polynesians could get together, could get all the way to.
I thought it was a dugout canoe, but anyway.
No. The canoes came and like brought them ashore. Anyway, great. I love Kentucky. Great book. In any case, yes, they came down as rafts, and then they went to Jaffa, and from Jaffa they were on camels brought up to the temple and
some serious labor.
Yeah, awesome. All right. The other thing is, so the borders are going to be laid out. And here I have to read verbatim. Hashem spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan at Jericho across from Mike Foyer's house, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you cross the Jordan to the land of Canaan, you shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land before you, and you shall destroy all their prostration stones," not their prostate stones, but prostration stones, "all their molten images you shall destroy, and all their high places you shall demolish. You shall possess the land, and you shall settle it for to you have I given the land to possess it. You shall give the land as an inheritance by lot to your families. To the many, you shall increase its inheritance, and to the few, you shall decrease its inheritance. Wherever its lot shall fall, his shall it be. According to the tribes of your fathers, you shall inherit. But if you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land before you, those of them who you leave shall be pins in your eyes and a surrounding barrier of thorns in your sides, and they shall harass you upon the land in which you dwell. And it shall be that what I had meant to do to them, I shall do to you." Meaning to say, I meant to kick them out, and you haven't done that, and you will be the one kicked out. A lot to say here, but to me,
at the same time, it almost doesn't need commentary.
Right, it doesn't need that much commentary, but like, look, we have today in our land jihadist elements that want to destroy us. They should not be here. Okay, this is different than the proselyte, the goyim, Gentiles, proselytes. I'm meant to be in this land, and we are meant to give them rights and decencies and liberties. But those who are antithetical to your rights here in this land, that's one point. The other point I want to say is last year I gave a speech on Tisha B'Av at the Najim Atar walk, those women in green walk around the old city walls, and I said, God says, we're always worrying about giving liberties to churches and mosques and different peoples, but God says, be liberal with me. Give me one small little place in this world. I didn't ask you Jews to go and destroy idolatry throughout the world. You're not like Islam, a conquering religion. This little room, this tiny place, be liberal with me.
Mm-hmm.
Give me a space, just one clean space, for the service of God, and you'll see that if you're liberal with me in this tiny space, the whole world will change.
Absolutely.
Just give me a space. Don't give them a space. Don't give them chanaya ba'aretz. Don't give them parking in the land or, right? Lo techanem. Don't give them that. Give that to me. Give me chanaya.
So I think that this kind of connects the loop back to the discussion we were having earlier about, you know, when you said my students would hesitate around the slaughter of the innocents, right? which already itself frames the question. It's the slaughter of the opposing nation.
Right.
And so to hear, you know, in this question, look, how does morality, does morality change?
Right.
Right. And you already made a very important distinction, which is the clear match of the Torah here is that if you don't believe that I've given you this land and that your role is to go in and possess it, then you will not hold on to it. And the symptom of that will be the fact that these people whom I have commanded you here in this particular time and place that I give you the Torah is to kill them all, because that's how we roll, so to speak, in the ancient world. If you show that you don't believe me by not doing that, well, it's very simple what will happen. So in 2018 or 5778, we don't, you know, line up the men, women, and children and kill them anymore, not after the Nazis. But nevertheless, I heard you say a very clear moral statement. Just, but the element of the society with which we are struggling that refuses to accept us, if we harbor them, that means that we don't believe God when he said that it's actually ours. Meaning to give liberties and civil rights and protections to peoples is a human act. In fact, I believe that the Torah mandates it under certain contexts. But we have to do that because we believe that that's what the Torah mandates. If we don't have a core belief that our being in this land is a mission, as you said, to make that space for God in the world, then there is a stone missing from our foundation.
I totally 100% agree, but I want to buttress that to say that you just anchored that in spirituality and belief of God, belief in Torah.
Yes.
But I want to tell you that a plain Russian Jew understands that, and to me... that's the other side. That also works perfectly by the laws of man and the rights of nations.
And you can't have two kings use the same crown. Right? If we're a people in the land, then there can't be another people in the land. There can't be another people.
Right, okay. Or let's just make it simple. There can't be a competing national narrative that is antithetical to your narrative.
Which was born in the antithesis.
From here, right now, from your house right now, from this place, I see no-go zones for Jews.
That is true. Absolutely.
Jihadist no-go zones.
Yep. And it's backside of where you used to live.
Right.
You probably know it fairly well.
Absolutely. I know it. I know those streets. And those are dangerous streets.
Mm-hmm.
And you certainly could not look like an overtly looking Jew by yourself walking through them. That's a problem.
Yep.
That's a problem. And in that sense, there is exactly the fulfillment of what I told you to do, which is to get rid of these kind of elements. They're getting rid of you on your land.
Without even getting into our own fair government.
Okay.
What it does.
We got to finish off here. There's two more stories that are important. One is the story of the Levite cities, the cities of refuge. And that's an amazing societal system of how to get rid of how to deal with people who have killed inadvertently and to create these cities where people do repentance. There's three cities on this side of the land of Israel. There'll be three cities on the other side.
And the cities that you're speaking about, which were given to the Levim as their personal inheritance,
right,
also serve that role.
Right. So these cities are basically Levite cities are like these like tshuva cities. That's the way I see them. It's like Tshuva Town.
It's also a sign that we've always been a hot-blooded people.
Right.
I mean, this is a practical necessity. You see how many times the Torah starts mentioning cities of refuge.
Right.
You see, like, you know, the honor killing that happens in the world out there. And this is what I meant about moral evolution. It's like, that's a real aspect of human culture. We used to do that. Granted, it was 3,000-plus years ago. Why don't we do it anymore? Its origin is here in the Torah. The Torah says, listen, I know you do that. I'm not going to be stupid and tell you not to do that because I know this is who you are, but I can change you. I can change you by commanding you in ways in which you will adapt and grow and become that which I know you can be.
Cities of refuge, cities, they're like you go there and you were hot-blooded and you stop the other hot-blooded guy.
Yep.
And then you're gonna do tshuva here.
Right. And think about it. We don't need
Hebron
such a thing
is
anymore.
One of those cities.
Absolutely.
Right. Hebron is one of those. We don't need things like that anymore, you say?
In Jewish culture, I don't think so. I don't think Jews are out there. Hot-bloodedly killing each other and doing honor. It's not a part of our culture anymore.
No, but maybe we are. I would say that there is a place for that today, and that's on the roads, the driving culture.
It's true.
I would
There's
say
a lot of rage
killed,
out there.
If you killed, we have about 500 deaths a year. I think if you killed somebody on the road, you should go to a city of refuge and do some kind of tshuva.
That's a beautiful statement, meaning there is still a further role of moral development that these cities could play, because so many of those deaths are unnecessary.
So many.
Senseless because people don't value life.
There's anger on the roads. There's road rage. And that road rage is in a death machine. And I think to myself, you have killed inadvertently. I'm sure you didn't mean to kill, but you did not drive cautiously. And you need to.
That's like a Chazak message to get out there. I'm going to think about how to put that into
I see. I see it all the time. I see people.
More people on the roads than in the wars. It's insane.
Oh, yeah. And you can see it as a you know, and I'm just like you.
Yeah, it's an unhealthy culture.
Right. It's a tarbut ra. Exactly. Finally, we have the story of the five awesome gals, the contra, I guess, to the Bnot Midian.
Yeah.
Okay. The anti Midianite gals, which is the five amazing women. The daughters of Tzlafchad. Once again, they're back in the news when their tribe says, cool that they're getting the inheritance of their father, but we're going to lose. Our tribe is going to lose, right? So it's like a yin-yang. They're like, we want the inheritance of their fathers. And then the men come and say, okay, that's really beautiful, but our tribe is going to lose its inheritance.
When you marry somebody from another tribe and they inherit you.
It's so we're going to get, you know, erosion. Tough call. Moses says, no problem. These amazing five women can marry whoever they want.
In your tribe.
As long as they're in the tribe.
Tribe of Menashe. And they're eminently marriageable.
We have any color car you want as long as it's black, you know.
Right.
It's you know, but the truth of the matter is I really have a feeling that the Torah basically says it. They did find, and it says very, very carefully, it says, whoever finds favor in their eyes. It's not like the women were forced, but for just like you asked for inheritance sake, so too for inheritance sake, you cannot erode your tribe's inheritance. They married their cousins within the tribes, and yes, they got married and they had big families and all that, and that's the way the book ends. And the book ends really with the tribe of Menashe, who is now going to be split in half in part. The reason they're split in half is because they're going to try to hold on to those two tribes that are on the other side. So there's going to be a bridge.
It's straddle.
There's going to be a straddle. But these tribes have become Zionist, as opposed to forgetting about their promise to God, as opposed to forgetting about the promise that they made to Joseph, saying, let's turn back to Egypt. No, now these tribes show that they want the land.
They're involved in the project.
They want the inheritance. They're going to hold on across the divide with their brothers in the outside of the land of Israel. It is in the land of Israel, but not. It's outside in the Transjordan.
Right.
We're going to hold on together, and that's it. We're parking now at Yarden Yericho, at Jordan Jericho, and it's time. It's the end of a book. It's the end of really four books. Together, it's all tied up, and now it's time to hear the big speech, the big talk, the 30-day talk from Moses that's going to start next week. Rabbi Mike Feuer, thank you very much.
It's always a pleasure. I'm so happy you came here to visit me at home.
Yes, and I really am glad that we got a chance to do this Torah portion while looking at the land, a room that we work in.
It's a bit of a cave.
It's a little bit of a cave, right? And here we're looking onto the land. We're looking on the borders of the land. What's up? And of course, as I look onto the land of Israel, I remember the great hosts of this show, which is the Land of Israel Network, which has so many other great shows. I want to thank everybody out there that is part of the show, that listens to the show, that writes me emails. I got a lot of great emails last week about a different issue altogether, which was Malka's defense of Little House on the Prairie books.
Uh-huh.
Okay,
Laura
Ingalls Wilder. I got a lot of email. People was like, "Right on!"
Yeah, people.
I got pictures from Switzerland, being like, "Here's my set of books. We'll stand for it."
You know, you can't. They're messing with the core there.
It's just funny that the Yishai Fleischer show with Malka Fleischer
defending Little House on the Prairie. Like you said, from one settler to another.
That's right. But from the Wild West, from the West Bank to the Wild West. All right, folks, that's right, because we live out there, you know, where I live, it's the Long Island of the West Bank. You know? That's what I now call the Long Island of the West Bank. In any case, folks, thank you so much for being with me. Malka Fleischer's up next, so stay tuned. Rabbi Mike Feuer, thank you again for a fabulous session. Thank you for finishing the book of Bamidbar, the book of Numbers, with us. And may Hashem give us strength to continue to the book of Deuteronomy, the book of Levi next. God bless you, folks. Stay tuned, stay strong, stay connected wherever you are. God bless you, and shalom.
All men dream, but not equally, says T.E. Lawrence. Those who dream by night in the dusty recesses of their minds wake in the day to find that it was vanity. But the dreamers of the day are dangerous men. They may act their dream with open eyes to make it possible. Now I'm trying to keep my eyes open and watch as my dream unfolds around me, because I'm Rav Mike Foyer, and this is The Jewish Story.
Join Rav Mike Foyer for the best Jewish history podcast, The Jewish Story, on the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com.
All right, folks, welcome back to the Yishai Fleischer Show. This part of the show broadcasting from Judea, and now not the desert, but back in Gush Etzion. Maka Fleischer, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks, Yishai. It's good to be back this week.
It's great to have you on. And you got some great stories, including earthquakes, meat quakes, and Temple Mount issues and selling land to Jews. A lot of stuff that's happening here in the Holy Land. A lot of stuff is shaking, that's right.
Well, let's see. What should we talk about first?
I'm interested in the meat story.
Okay, so let's talk about that. This is an interesting story. Basically, I learned some information that I didn't know about how Israelis eat meat.
We Israelis.
Why do I have to say it like that?
You know, because we are speaking in English, and somebody might think that we're commenting about Israelis. But we are Israelis speaking English, and I am
commenting about Israelis as an Israeli.
About us, I just like to say a lot of times when you're an Israeli, when you're an Anglo-Israeli or a Russian-speaking Israeli, and you say "you Israelis" or "the Israelis," no, we want to say "we Israelis," right? That way we don't like alienate anybody, and then we feel like people are like, okay, you know, you could say whatever you want as long as you're including yourself into that.
We eat meat in a very interesting way. Basically,
we eat meat. I didn't hear you well.
We eat meat right. In a very interesting way.
Okay.
Basically, it turns out that we import some of our meat. If you live here in Israel, you know that you go into the frozen food section and you see a lot of Spanish. And that is because a lot of our meat is imported from Argentina. Beef in particular is imported from Argentina. They grass feed the cows down there and then they shech them. And then they freeze the meat, and then they bring it, they ship that to Israel, and you can buy a lot of kosher meat in Israel that was raised in Argentina. But it happens to be that, and it turns out that Israel imports live animals also from foreign countries, like a lot of our sheep, it turns out, are imported from Australia. The sheep arrive here. Then they are shechted, they are slaughtered according to Jewish law, and then the meat is sold, right? So the animal is shipped, the animal is slaughtered, it's cut into meat, and then sold in the market. That sounds okay, except what? It turns out that during the process of coming from Australia and other countries to Israel, these sheep and calves, also like young cows, are shipped for meat, also for veal. They suffer terribly. It turns out that the process is like not a beautiful process, and they end up arriving in Israel dirty, exhausted, dried out, and just generally traumatized from like a long sea voyage. And then they're slaughtered here, and it's not nice. So there's a new bill in the Knesset which will, over the next 3 years, reduce by 25% each year the number of live sheep and calves which are going to be imported from Australia and Europe to Israel in order to basically phase out that way of bringing meat to Israel altogether within like 3 or 4 years. And what will happen basically is that instead slaughterhouses will be either utilized or erected in the countries where the meat is coming from. Slaughters will happen on home soil of these animals. And then the meat will be shipped to Israel. It'll be frozen or, you know, however it is that they transport meat. Because there's been a big uproar, including apparently even Sarah Netanyahu herself, the wife of the prime minister, has been really behind the kind of abolishment of this practice of bringing in live animals for slaughter, because of the horrible conditions that it turns out they're in. And some rabbis, there have been a bunch of people who signed on to all kinds of laws calling for a halt to the live shipments. It turns out that 228 Israeli lawyers signed a petition asking for a halt to the live shipments. And in May, 60 rabbis signed a letter stating that it's neither the way of the Torah nor of human morality to allow such cruelty to animals. I'm very happy about it. I personally am totally cool with buying some frozen meat. I think that's fine. It turns out that the market for meat in Israel has increased very greatly. The practice of bringing in the live animals was supposed to be reduced kind of, by policy decision, sort of. But Agriculture Minister Uri Ariel, had to answer to this committee that erected the bill. And they're like, dude, what happened? We were supposed to decrease the number of live animals. And he basically said that in 1 year, the market for meat or the...
consumer
desire for meat has increased by 25%. So it turns out that Israelis are eating way more meat, particularly of these kind of large animals like sheep and cows, than they were even the last year. Which is interesting also. Israelis are known for participating in the kind of Mediterranean diet, which is high in fish, high in salads, high in
olive oils
and avocados and these kind of nuts and these vegan fats. You know what I mean? And now it looks like the Israeli diet is shifting a little bit. I wonder what that's going to mean. I'm not going to really talk too much about this news story, but there was a report done about OECD countries and how Israel ranks in terms of other quote unquote Western countries in terms of health. And it turns out that Israel's healthcare system could use some work. Basically, it's sort of the real problem with the Israeli healthcare system, it seems, is an overcrowding thing. There's not enough doctors, there's not enough nurses, there's not enough hospital beds, there's not enough diagnostic machines. I mean, we have these things, but we could really use more. And there are other countries in the OECD which have way more.
Right.
Of all these resources than Israel has. And it's interesting because there's tons and tons of Israeli medical school students, but there's not a lot of hiring.
No, there's not tons of medical students. A lot of these students have to go abroad.
Right, but they do. Meaning to say their Israeli kids want to learn medicine.
Absolutely.
There's 58% of Israeli medical students are learning outside of Israel, which
that is
wild. Nuts.
That's wild.
We really, I'm calling out now to all the listeners who are doctors. I know we have doctors, great, incredible healers who are out there listening to this show. You want to do yourself a legacy? You erect yourself a medical school in this country. We need some more medical schools in our beautiful Israel. I think that would make a big difference here.
Doctors aren't the ones who erect medical schools, Malka. Who erects medical schools are universities and conglomerates.
But you need funding and all these things.
Right,
need to get behind some, take out their checkbooks and get together and create some medical schools in Israel.
Right.
But wait, the point that I wanted to make, you seem to have attached to this particular issue of who starts medical schools. But what I really wanted to say is that all these things are kind of missing here in Israel. But one thing that's interesting is that Israel has the second highest life expectancy among the OECD countries. I think the first one was Japan.
Maybe it's because we don't have too many doctors. Maybe that's actually the reason,
right? Yeah, that's
interesting.
So anyway, what I wanted to say is that now that Israelis are increasing their meat consumption, I wonder what's going to happen. I wonder, some people like to make a correlation between heavy amounts of meat eating and life expectancy. I wonder what will happen.
Right. I want to say just about the medical school issue. There's a reason I'm actually attached to this issue is because I actually think that we're missing an opportunity for big business. One of the big businesses that Israel could have is instead of people going to, they go to Italy, they go to Bologna, they go to.
There's a lot of Hungarian. Israelis go to Hungary and.
They go to the Caribbean.
Countries.
They go to all kinds of places to learn medicine. And I'm just like, hello, we can have a business in this country. We're the world, and especially Africa and Asia comes, and parts of Europe will come here to learn
for
from.
For sure, I think Israel from Israeli... should be a world center for emergency medicine and for like gyno, you know, OBGYN type medicine, like birth type medicine.
We're not experts at emergency medicine. That was actually brought in from America. Okay, the expertise, like these American doctors, like Dr. Applebaum, he brought emergency medicine
to
Israel.
Absolutely, absolutely. But it also happens to be that I know that emergency services come to Israel, different emergency services teams from around the world come to Israel to learn how to deal with specific kinds of emergencies.
Right. In any case, bigger medical schools for more people. We are, Jews love to be doctors. That's like something that we do well. So, you know, we really should increase that thing. And it should be a government, you know, decision to make more medical schools to open it up to the
world. I don't know what the hang up is. I don't know what the hold up is. I don't know why it's not happening.
I think what happens is whenever they try to open up another university, like the other universities are like, wait, you're stepping on our turf and stuff like that.
Gosh, I hope that's not true.
Speaking of stepping on turf, you mentioned Uri Ariel, and Uri Ariel stepped on a turf that he loves to step on, which is the Temple Mount. Now he himself, he's a minister. He's a Kohen. He made a project.
I didn't know he's a Kohen.
He's a big time Kohen, and he's very proud of that. He blesses people all the time.
Is that right?
And he was even on the Temple Mount one time a few years ago, giving people Birkat Kohanim. Yes, he's big into that, and he's big into the Temple Mount. And he had been blocked for some time by the Prime Minister, who made a decision that Knesset members and cabinet members, all that, cannot go up on the Temple Mount at all because it was too explosive. That ban has been lifted. And I got to see Knesset member Sharon Haskell, and I got to see Minister Uri Ariel, and I think some other ones on the Temple Mount doing their thing. They even caught.
What do you mean you got to see them? You were up there at the same time?
No, I
you watched it on television.
Yeah, I saw it.
It's like you were practically
there.
I
didn't personally get to see it, but I felt as though I got to see it because I was so happy to see them there. There's even a picture of Sharon Haskell on her cell phone close to the Temple Mount. And, you know, the caption was, she's talking to God.
Oh, that's funny.
It was cute. But it was just good to see the Israeli Knesset members back in the heart of the Holy Land.
Right. The Prime Minister, I don't know what this rule is about, but basically he said that all the cabinet members can go back up to the Temple Mount. They were banned like something like 2 years ago by the Prime Minister because of like all kinds of action that was going on the Temple Mount and all kinds of controversy and uproar, and he wanted to contain that, so he forbade cabinet members from going up.
Are you sure it's not just regular Knesset members?
Which was a big outrage.
Because Sharon Haskell is just a regular Knesset member. I don't think she's a cabinet member.
Okay, lawmakers.
Yeah, lawmakers. Yeah.
So anyway, they were all forbidden from going up there, and it caused a big ruckus in Israel, and people were like, what is this? Harabait Beyadenu, the Temple Mount's supposed to be in our hands. What is this? Anyway, it's back in our hands, it looks like, the temple.
Wait, it's back-ish in our hands.
Back-ish.
Because we all know that our beloved state of Israel, at the same time, while, you know, giving the Knesset members the right to go back up there, we do go up there.
Only once every 3 months.
Oh, is that right?
I don't understand what that law is. I guess he doesn't want people to become regulars.
Don't go there too much. Go there just a little bit.
4 times a year. I don't know where he got this number or why.
Yeah, and that's exactly it. You know, I'm going to say something harsh, which is our beloved state of Israel that we have yearned for and prayed for is also the mechanism that the machinery that defends and upholds the laws of dehimitude, jihadist dehimitude on the Temple Mount. And that's absurd, and the situation is absurd there, because Jews are not allowed to pray there normally. Probably the Knesset members are allowed to because they have diplomatic immunity. And when they're up there, they could do kind of what they want. But the bottom line is the average Jew, the average Joseph, cannot pray there normatively, and there's no spot for us. And I'm just saying that the Temple Mount is not a normal situation yet, but thank God that is a step back in the right direction, which is Knesset members up there.
Right, although MK Hanin Zouabi from the Arab Joint List, one of my favorite nemesis, I guess, one of my favorite personal nemesis.
Yes.
She goes like this. This is her quote about how Jews are allowed to go back up under the Temple Mount, onto the Temple Mount, if they are lawmakers in this country. Netanyahu will not tell Muslims, MKs, or anyone else when to enter and when to pray. Anyone who is not a Muslim has no reason to be there, she
dun,
says.
Dun, dun.
Anyone who is not a Muslim has no reason to be there. I like that she can say it out loud. I wish some of our politicians would be able to say things like that without, you know, everyone going,
Yeah, she says, she'll say, that's right. She'll just be like, that's right. You have no right on the Temple Mount. You have no business being there.
Right.
Because
she's
it's
like,
the Haram
oh,
al-Sharif. You're not from here. You don't deserve to be here. And you should zip it.
Speaking of Muslims and non-Muslims, Yishai.
Speaking of
them. I got another story. Muslims and not Muslims. And it's another Temple Mount story, kind of, which is that Sheikh Mohammed Hussein, who's the Palestinian Mufti of Jerusalem, who can regularly be seen up on the Temple Mount, and who, in fact, got his job from PA Chieftain Mahmoud Abbas in something like 2006, 2008, as he used to be the caretaker for the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And that's how he got his job as the Mufti of Jerusalem, the Palestinian Mufti of Jerusalem. He issued a fatwa on Tuesday. A fatwa is a religious ruling saying this. He says, quote unquote, the land of Palestine, quote unquote, is an inalienable religious endowment forbidden to sell to, quote unquote, the enemies. That's you and me. We're the enemies.
Okay.
Okay. Under the pain of being labeled an infidel and a traitor. If you, Palestinian, quote unquote, sell land to Jews, you are an infidel and a traitor. He says that any Muslim facilitating the transfer of ownership of any part of Jerusalem or the land of Palestine to the enemies is a heretic, a non-believer, and a traitor to God, Islam, and the homeland. And that if you are caught doing such an onerous thing as to sell land to Jewish people, no one should marry you, no one should attend your funeral, no one should allow you to be buried in a Muslim cemetery or do any kind of business with you. You're out if you sell land to the Jews. And it seems like people are saying that this fatwa is in response to a new bill which was brought to the Knesset by Jewish Home Party MK Bezalel Smotrich, one of your favorite Knesset members, Yishai.
Absolutely.
Who wants to create a bill allowing Jews to purchase land anywhere in Area C in Judea and Samaria. That's one of the three areas, basically. There's Area A, Area B, and Area C. Because a 1953 Jordanian law that Israel kind of follows forbids non-Muslims and non-Arabs from purchasing land in Judea and Samaria. So you have to know that here in Israel, our law is a bunch of recycling bin, basically, of other nations and entities that ruled over Israel before we got here. And for some insane reason, when we established our own court system, instead of just dumping all the stuff that came before us and going, you know, let's just start over. We're sovereigns now and we're going to start our own thing and like, let's do our own laws. And Jewish law has lots of stuff and let's look around and see what we like. Instead, they were like, let's just take all the laws of all the empires that were here before. Let's take some Turkish law. We'll do a little British law. We got some Jordanian law. Let's just put all that together. We'll add a little bit of some of our stuff, and then we'll call that the law of Israel. So it can be very, very confused, not to mention the fact that there is many different land areas that have been either, you know, that have basically been acquired over time. And so it's all very confusing. So Bezalel Smotrich trying to turn back, or I don't know if it's really turn back the clock, but like push forward the clock, make some progress for us since 1953 Jordanian occupation of Judea and Samaria, and trying to get us out from under this Jordanian law.
I'm not exactly certain of how that Jordanian law works. I never understood that we weren't allowed to purchase land in Area C. I've never heard that. I do know that the Palestinian Authority has a law by which if you sell land to Jews, you will face, and you'll be caught, you'll face death, meaning to say it is illegal in the Palestinian Authority to sell land to Jews. That I know for sure. And there have been people who have been hanged in the street, to square, in the squares of cities for selling land to Jews. And I know that it still happens, that we do purchase property. We in Hebron, we recently purchased property. And so I don't know exactly how that 1953 law works. What always amazes me is that it's one thing to follow British law, and it's another thing to follow Turkish law. These were both sovereigns. These were both sovereigns that had a semi-legitimate control on this land. Certainly the British had international legal right to administer this area in terms of being a mandate to create a Jewish state, and then also the Arab states along with the French. They created the Syria, they created Lebanon, Mesopotamia, which was Iraq, and Jordan. So it's very important to distinguish between them, who is a legitimate sovereign, and Jordan, who's an illegitimate sovereign. Jordan occupied the land in 1948. They
so you're saying you're okay with Israel being run on Turkish and British law, but you're not okay with Israel being run on Jordanian law.
There's a difference between running on a law, which I agree with you, what you said before, which is there's no reason to actually follow other people's legal systems, which is and legal precedent, because we didn't have precedent, so that's why they picked it. That's one thing. And then there is following the rulings that they had specifically in this land. When it comes to Jordan, we don't have Jordanian law that we follow. We have Jordanian decisions that we follow, right? And we like sales and other things. We're like, well, Jordan allotted this land to these people, so we should follow that. And that to me is absurd. There's absolutely no reason why Israel should give any credence whatsoever to the 19 years of an occupation. And you know, this willingness, basically, you have a fake king who took over our land in 1948. 19 years he held on to this land. Then he allotted it to different people. There's absolutely no reason why we should pay attention legally to his arbitrary decisions. Why should we care about that? And I was contemplating trying to pass a law in the Knesset. Other people told me it's not a good idea. I didn't understand why. But to pass a law in the Knesset to say, Israeli courts, you should be barred from contemplating Jordanian decisions in those 19 years when considering which land ownership questions. Meaning to say, who cares what the Jordanian king allotted to his friends or whatever? Who cares? It doesn't matter. You should not be even allowed to consider that in law. And I think that law, basically to eviscerate those 19 years of occupation as any legal precedent or any legal decision at all in terms of land ownership. If we could do that, if we could get to that point, that would be great. A lot of the problems that we have here close by in Netiv Avot, what we had in Amona, and what's the other one? Maka, we had Amona, then the one Migron. All these problems that we had are all stemming from the same thing. Some Jordanian allotment of land to some cousin of his or some farmer who never farmed it, and then somebody says, oh, look, the Jordanian king, he gave this land to somebody. It's like, who cares? Well, why should Israel recognize that at all? That is something that if we could get rid of, we'd be in much better state. But alas, it's not there yet. Maybe Bezalel Smotrich. Now, Malka, that fatwa is probably just specifically a decision regarding Jerusalem, because in Jerusalem, these Arabs are living not under PA law, but they're living under regular Israeli law in Arab neighborhoods. And there they are selling to Israelis and to Jews. And this Jerusalem mufti is trying to say to those Arabs, you know, Allah is going to punish you because he doesn't have that PA control over the Arabs.
Yes and no, Yishai. I know that there's other cities that this is an issue. In fact, I mean, this happens to, yes, be a Jerusalem story, but I remember one time I was walking in the parking lot of the Mount Zion parking lot, because I used to work in the old city of Jerusalem, and I parked my car on Mount Zion because that is the incredible good fortune that I had to have a parking lot on Mount Zion. And I was walking into to the Zion Gate, and before I got to Zion Gate, an Arab-like cleaning person of the someone who was taking care of the parking lot, sweeping up or whatever, there kind of walks up to me, and I'm wary of that, right? So he walks up to me and he's like, I want to sell my property to Jews. He goes. And I'm like.
Because he saw you and he knew that you were.
I don't know how he knew.
It's for simple. He knew that you weren't ultra-Orthodox. He knew you were a settler. And he figured you're one of the settlers who had connection, which you do.
So wait.
Was he right or wrong?
So I go, give me your phone number. I took his phone number.
So he was right.
And I passed it on. I didn't follow up. I don't know what happened.
Right.
But I tried to facilitate that. Yes, great.
Very good.
I just want to say, though, Yishai, I don't know if we want to get into all this controversy now.
Or controversy.
But this story made me think. You know, when I report a story like this about a fatwa, it sounds very intense and very outrageous, kind of, that he would issue such an edict. But I wonder, Yishai, I don't want to put you on the spot, but maybe I'll put you on the spot. What do you think about a Jew selling land to an Arab in the land of Israel? I don't know about the death penalty. I'm pretty confident I know what you're going to say about something like that. But, like, let's say for a second that a rabbi issued a psak, halakha, okay? A halakhic ruling saying any Jew who sells land to an Arab, don't marry them, don't give them an aliyah to the Torah, don't do business with them, don't speak to them. What do you think about that?
I think the answer is very simple, actually. I don't have a problem with that fatwa because it's like anti-Semitic or racist or anti-Jewish. That's not my issue. My issue is here's a group of people living on my land who have, an antithetical national narrative to Israel. That's what bothers me. It doesn't bother me that he's making some kind of anti-Semitic. I know that the jihad is anti-Semitic. That's not what bothers me. What bothers me is that, like, we have within our own country these kind of folks who are administering parcels of land and control of our Temple Mount, and that's the real face of them. I have no problem whatsoever I have no problem with a rabbi saying that. I have no problem with a rabbi saying don't sell to Arabs. And I really don't have a problem with an Arab saying don't sell to Jews in the Arab lands. If an Arab leader said,
obviously,
don't
Shai, the whole deal is that they don't recognize your ownership on this.
But I'm saying that's what bothers me, not the anti-Semitic.
Why would that bother you, though? Isn't that like something that's like a
the jihad?
The jihad.
Yes. So therefore, that story is just a symptom of it that shows the reality, which is we have jihadists in our land. If a Saudi Arabian prince was like, don't sell land to Jews in our homeland in Saudi Arabia, I'd be like, okay, don't sell it to foreigners. Let's say a Saudi Arabian was like, don't sell land to foreigners, it's against Islam in Saudi Arabia. I'm like, okay, great, I get that. It's your lands. This is our land, and in our land are groups of people that are antithetical to our national claim. Meaning to say, in simple words, there are enemies in our land.
They want your land to be their land.
Right. So there are enemies in my land. That's what to me is. And also, we fight that by trying to buy those lands. But really, we should evict jihadists. And the decent people should stay on this land and be, the welcomed guests and have civil rights, but not national rights. These people are claiming national rights to destroy our national story, to destroy Israel.
You know, Isha, I went to the grocery store here in Gush Etzion, it's called Tzomet HaGush, and there's the Gush Junction, and there's a mall, because I love the mall. There's sushi there, there's a schnitzel store, there's a pizza store, there's a Fox Home.
Listen,
we got everything.
We're in the Long Island of the West Bank.
Yeah,
here,
anyway,
you know?
So I went there. And I had to go to get into the grocery store, the Rami Levy grocery store. There's like a little security, like a little, metal detector thing and a guard. So you go through. For me, it's never an issue, right? But this time I went through and the guard asked to look in my bag, which is very, very commonplace, right? You go into public buildings and they want to see your bag. So I showed him my bag and I was kind of wondering what's going on. And then I looked over to my left and I saw that there was a man going back and forth through the metal detector, right? Because he kept beeping. So he kept being sent back into the metal detector. And I saw that it was obviously an Arab man, right? Not a Jewish man. It was an Arab man. And then I saw ahead of him were like four members of his family who had been through the metal detector, women in hijabs and other men. And there were other, like, it was a big group of people going to the grocery store, because Jews and Arabs go to the grocery store together because it is not an apartheid here. We all go to the grocery store and enjoy.
But not in Ramallah.
Not in Ramallah. I cannot go there, even though, right, I've always wanted to go and see what it looks like there. Anyway, but this person had to go through like a whole security check, and his family had been through a whole security check. And I got to tell you, inside my heart for a second, I felt a little bad. I felt a little not right. Like, it felt, I mean, I love to get through a line fast, right? I'm a real Middle Easterner. Like, oh, I cut you off. Good for me. You know what I mean? But at the same time, I was like, this feels kind of sad. Like, these people just want to go to the grocery store, you know? And this guy, like, has to put his belt back on, and he has to, like, his family's waiting for him, and it's like a whole thing. And it's in public, right? I've made it through the grocery store in 1 second, sure, whereas he's, like, kind of being embarrassed in front of everybody by being, like, a suspicious person, you know?
Sure.
And I felt a little bad. And then I thought to myself, I wonder what I would say if I had, like, a left-leaning person with me who was like, look at this. Look at this discrimination. Look at this poor person.
Humiliation.
Who has to, right? And I in that moment, I had sympathy for those thoughts, right? I had sympathy for those feelings.
Good.
But then I realized that I knew exactly what I would say. And what I would say is, you're right. It is really very unfortunate to see people go through something like this, that I go through a line and I'm okay, and then this guy next to me goes through a line, he's not okay,
right.
He has to be. It is a you know, there's many levels of humiliation. I would say this was a low level humiliation, but nonetheless, it's not nice. I wouldn't want it for me, right? I wouldn't have enjoyed that experience. But then I think to myself, what I would have said is, you're right, you know, it is a little bit humiliating and it is uncomfortable, and they do have another layer of security stuff that they have to deal with that's very unpleasant. And so what they should do is look inward in their society and obliterate the bad elements that make it so that they have to go through these things all the time. Israel, we, Malka, we have no choice. There's no choice but to put a guard at the front of a grocery store and to check people who are suspicious people going into the grocery store, because we've had numerous bad experiences. Lots of precedent to suggest that if you don't take security measures, bad things are going to happen to good people. And we cannot have that. But people in the Palestinian Authority and in other places where there are large Arab populations in Israel, they should go inside of themselves and be like, yo, you're messing up my life. I just want to go to the grocery store. How about you stop attacking Jews and allow me to live a normal life where people don't suspect me anymore? You are screwing it up for me, terrorist guy. And either you get out of here or I'll make sure you get out of here. And we're going to take care of this together. And I felt calm again in my soul after having, like, talked that out with the left and right parts of me, kind of like having it out with myself. I definitely realized that we can't afford to be soft, because when we're soft, we get pummeled. And really, the Palestinian Authority Arabs, they can't afford to have these terrorists in their midst. It is against their interest. And if they would only look inward and attack these bad and harsh elements that suppress them, that destroy their lives, that threaten their children, that propagandize their young people, then we wouldn't have to see situations like this in which people are, you know, there's two different lines for people.
Quite right, Malka. I really have nothing to add. I think you said it just right. I do want to tell you that we are coming back home fearlessly, courageously, and we're coming back to live in our ancestral homeland, and we're being challenged for it. And these places like Hebron, East Jerusalem, here at even the Gush, are places where we have interactions with many Arabs, and we don't have a racist attitude towards them, but we are against the jihad. We will fight the jihad.
I think everyone should be against the jihad. That's
right.
The thing.
Right.
Any normal person who wants a normal life, this fatwa, which was issued by the Mufti of Jerusalem, it wasn't just there to say, hey, love the land of, we'll call it Palestine, okay? Love the land of Palestine and don't sell it to anybody. It's like, it's there as a threat. And this is the kind of bad entity that these people, that good people need to get rid of, because these people are threatening and overseeing their whole lives. And I wish they would want the freedom that they keep demanding from us. I wish that they would go inside of themselves and eradicate these bad elements.
And that's what I told
Yossi
Beilin. That's what I told Yossi Beilin. I said, you act like you're such a, this was one of the fathers of the two-state solution. I'm like, you act like you're so liberal. What liberal thing have you done? You've empowered the most illiberal forces to destroy the lives of these people that you're like so care about. You don't care about them. You didn't give them a life under Palestine. You gave them suppression. Maka, I want to wind things up, and I want to thank you very much for being with me today.
Thank you.
I want you to know that I got a new flag from the City of David.
Ooh,
for our flag,
nice.
Flag collection. It's not a big one. It's not a very big flag.
Yeah, but it flew in the City of David.
It flew in the City of David for the first time in 2,000 years. And my good buddy Zev from City of David procured it for me. I'm very happy about that. And it can be yours. You can have one of the first flags in 2,000 years that has flown in the City of David.
City.
That's right, David City. It's an incredible thing. It still has the dust of Jerusalem. This one's in great shape.
Wow.
Just go to YishaiFleischer.com, the donate page there. We have a nice little system set up. And we ask for a minimum donation of $500 to make that happen. We have two flags from Hebron right now, and I think I have two from Jerusalem right
now.
Wow. Okay? They're beautiful. They're rare. We're selling a story. That's what my friends have said. It's like, we're not selling you a flag.
Really, what we're doing is selling you a flag, the new flag that you don't get into your house, the new flag that goes flying up somewhere else.
That's right. That's right.
To show everyone
but for
that
you,
the Jewish people are back.
Right, but for you, we're selling you. We're not selling it to you. We're giving you. And we're asking for you to be part of that, to be part of history, to be part of what I call building Israel together. That's what I call it. Israel. Kuma is our organization, our 501, and its mission is to build Israel together. I also want to thank the good folks at Hebron. And right now, during the summer, Malka, we have two tours a week.
Wow.
Two English tours a week, okay, for people coming, two tours a week to Hebron. And it's just that simple. Just go to hebronfund.org and come visit the mothers and the fathers. Come visit the mothers and the fathers. I want to thank the folks at janglo.net for being the super highway of information about what's happening in Israel in the English language. That's janglo.net. And I want to thank thelandofisrael.com for doing great, great stuff. Also, if you're listening, please sign up for the Land of Israel emails. Please sign up for YishaiFleischer.com. Go there, check it out, and sign up for our weekly emails. And also dedicate a show, dedicate the Torah segment. We had a great segment with Rabbi Mike, and be part of it. And also, I want to see you a little bit. Send me a picture of yourself, of your family. Malka, I got a lot of pictures last week from your discussion of defending
Laura Ingalls Wilder.
That's right. I got people,
which I just read to the kids tonight.
People sent me photos of our good friend Jeanette in Switzerland sent me a picture of her set, and other people sent me pictures. I forwarded you an email. People are saying, like, yes, we stand with these great books. So you, Malka, from the West Bank, from the Long Island of the West Bank, defended something from the Wild West.
Wow, I'm proud.
From 150 years ago, so God bless you.
I just want to mention one more thing, since we're thanking all these amazing businesses. And since I talked about Tzomet HaGush and the mall and everything that's going on over there, I really want to tell everyone this really cool thing, right? Which is that the beauty of the Land of Israel, that's eternal. But now you can get some of the beauty of the Land of Israel right there on your nails. And in your hair, maybe a facial. Because my friend opened the first fully functional, full-service salon at the Gush Junction. It's called Silk Salon and Day Spa. It is gorgeous. It is top-notch. The service is impeccable. And it's my friend, silksalon.co.il. Anyone coming out to Israel want to get their nails done? You got to go over there. Support Judea. Support an American Ola who came and made her dream come true and wants to bring beauty to Jewish women in Judea and Arabs, by the way. She's ready to serve all the clientele. Very, very interesting. Her vision is that Arab women and Jewish women will be able to sit down together and have their nails done. That's like her dream.
I just had a total great vision for how a little video we're going to make for her. Okay. We're going to get like a British sounding person. We're going to make it look like it's CNN or BBC.
That is
be
really
like,
funny.
The settlers are starting a spa in the West Bank. It's meant to cater to Jews and Arabs. Some people think it will bring peace, while others think it'll bring war.
That's
okay,
funny.
We'll have a little
idea.
Bit of fun, and she'll
idea.
Do great. Silk spa.
What
Silky
you
settler
what do you
spa.
SilkySettlerSpa.com.
SilkySettlerSpa.
SilkSalon.co.il. Very, very nice. Women's only spa.
Settler chic. Silky. What is it again? Silk Salon Spa.
You're doing great, Ishai.
I know. I feel it. Okay, folks, God bless you wherever you are. Write us an email, Yishai@thelandofisrael.com, Yishai@thelandofisrael.com. Thanks again to the Land of Israel Network. Thank you to Malka for joining us today. Malka, Shabbat Shalom. Thank you so much.
Shabbat Shalom.
And thank you so much to God Almighty. Malka, I'm not going to lie to you. Sometimes I drive and I just get a tear when
you
I see.
You get a tear in your beer?
I get a tear in my beer when I see the beautiful Judea. Samaria, in the land of Israel, flourishing, Jerusalem.
It is looking really good.
It's
the
just,
air is really good out
it's
here.
Just beautiful. It's so big, so awesome, and if we could just have a small part of it. So thank you, God, for helping us have a small part of it, and please bless all of those listeners to have a portion, a part in the land of Israel, in the story of the land of Israel, in the fight for the land of Israel, and in the fight to honor your great name, God Almighty. Thank you so much for being out there. Stay tuned, stay strong, stay connected. Shalom and Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
Every time there was an offer for the Palestinians and they said no, they were rewarded. The negotiations weren't working.
Is conflict over when one side declares victory or the other side declares defeat? Hopefully you'll get the answers on today's Rejuvenation with me, Eve Harrow, on the Land of Israel Network, as I bring you the recordings from the Victory Caucus in the Knesset in Jerusalem from just a few days ago.
Rejuvenation with Eve Harrow at thelandofisrael.com.